We are sadly shocked at those worlds, at Terminus particularly, where sex seems to be considered a mere social pleasure of no great importance, to be indulged in when, how, and with whom one pleases, without regard to the values of religion. Trevise shrugged. I'm sorry, but I can't undertake to reform the galaxy, or even Terminus. And what has this to do with the matter of my ship? I'm talking about public opinion in the matter of your ship, and how it limits my ability to compromise the matter. The people of Camporeon would be horrified if they found you had taken a young and attractive woman on board to serve the lustful urges of you and your companion. It is out of consideration for the safety of the three of you that I have been urging you to accept peaceful surrender in place of a public trial. Trevise said, I see you have used the meal to think of a new type of persuasion by threat. Am I now to fear a lynch mob? I merely point out dangers. Will you be able to deny that the woman you have taken on board ship is anything other than a sexual convenience? Of course I can deny it. Bliss is the companion of my friend, Dr. Pellerat. He has no other competing companion. You may not define their state as marriage, but I believe that in Pellerat's mind, and in the woman's too, there is a marriage between them. Are you telling me you are not involved yourself? Certainly not, said Trevise. What do you take me for? I cannot tell. I do not know your notions of morality. Then let me explain that my notions of morality tell me that I don't trifle with my friend's possessions or his companionships. You are not even tempted? I can't control the fact of temptation, but there's no chance of my giving in to it. No chance at all? Perhaps you are not interested in women. Don't you believe that? I am interested. How long has it been since you have had sex with a woman?
Months.
Not at all since I left Terminus. Surely you don't enjoy that.
I certainly don't, said Trevise with strong feeling. But the situation is such that I have no choice.
Surely your friend Pellerat, noting your suffering, would be willing to share his woman.
I show him no evidence of suffering, but if I did, he would not be willing to share bliss. Nor, I think, would the woman consent. She is not attracted to me.
Do you say that because you have tested the matter?
I have not tested it. I make the judgment without feeling the need to test it. In any case, I don't particularly like her.
Astonishing! She is what a man would consider attractive.
Physically, she is attractive. Nevertheless, she does not appeal to me. For one thing, she is too young, too childlike in some ways.
Do you prefer women of maturity, then?
Trevise paused. Was there a trap here? He said cautiously, I am old enough to value some women of maturity, and what has this to do with my ship?
Lieselore said, For a moment, forget your ship. I am 46 years old, and I am not married. I have somehow been too busy to marry.
In that case, by the rules of your society, you must have remained continent all your life. Is that why you asked how long it has been since I have had sex? Are you asking my advice in the matter? If so, I say it is not food and drink. It is uncomfortable to do without sex, but not impossible. The minister smiled, and there was again that carnivorous look in her eyes.
Don't mistake me, Trevise. Rank has its privileges, and it is possible to be discreet. I am not altogether an abstainer. Nevertheless, Camporellian men are unsatisfying. I accept the fact that morality is an absolute good, but it does tend to burden the men of this world with guilt, so that they become unadventurous, unenterprising, slow to begin, quick to conclude, and, in general, unskilled.
Trevise said very cautiously, "There is nothing I can do about that either."
"Are you implying that the fault may be mine, that I am uninspiring?"
Trevise raised a hand. "I don't say that at all."
"In that case, how would you react given the opportunity? You, a man from an immoral world who must have had a vast variety of sexual experiences of all kinds, who is under the pressure of several months of enforced abstinence, even though in the constant presence of a young and charming woman. How would you react in the presence of a woman such as myself, who is the mature type you profess to like?"
Trevise said, "I would behave with the respect and decency appropriate to your rank and importance."
"Don't be a fool," said the minister. Her hand went to the right side of her waist. The strip of white that encircled it came loose and unwound from her chest and neck. The bodice of her black gown hung noticeably looser. Trevise sat frozen. Had this been in her mind since when? Or was it a bribe to accomplish what threats had not? The bodice flipped down, along with its sturdy reinforcement at the breasts. The minister sat there, with a look of proud disdain on her face, and bare from the waist up. Her breasts were a smaller version of the woman herself, massive, firm, and overpoweringly impressive.
"Well," she said.
Trevise said in all honesty, "Magnificent."
"And what will you do about it?"
"What does morality dictate on Camporeon, Madame Lieselore?
What is that to a man of Terminus? What does your morality dictate? And begin. My chest is cold and wishes warmth."
Trevise stood up and began to disrobe. Chapter 6. The Nature of Earth. 22. Trevise felt almost drugged and wondered how much time had elapsed. Beside him lay Mitza Lieselore, Minister of Transportation. She was on her stomach, head to one side, mouth open, snoring distinctly. Trevise was relieved that she was asleep. Once she woke up, he hoped she would be quite aware that she had been asleep. Trevise longed to sleep himself, but he felt it important that he not do so. She must not wait to find him asleep. She must realize that while she had been ground down to unconsciousness, he had endured. She would expect such endurance from a foundation-reared immoralist, and at this point it was better she not be disappointed. In a way, he had done well. He had guessed correctly that Lieselore, given her physical size and strength, her political power, her contempt for the Camporellian men she had encountered, her mingled horror and fascination with tales. What had she heard, Trevise wondered, of the sexual feats of the decadents of Terminus, would want to be dominated. She might even expect to be, without being able to express her desire and expectation. He had acted on that belief, and, to his good fortune, found he was correct. Trevise, the ever right, he mocked himself. It pleased the woman, and it enabled Trevise to steer activities in a direction that would tend to wear her out
while leaving himself relatively untouched. It had not been easy. She had a marvelous body. 46, she had said, but it would not have shamed a 25-year-old athlete. And enormous stamina. A stamina exceeded only by the careless zest with which she had spent it. Indeed, if she could be tamed and taught moderation, if practice, but could he himself survive the practice, brought her to a better sense of her own capacities, and, even more important, his, it might be pleasant to... The snoring stopped suddenly, and she stirred. He placed his hand on the shoulder nearest him and stroked it lightly, and her eyes opened. Trevise was leaning on his elbow and did his best to look unworn and full of life. "I'm glad you were sleeping, dear," he said. "You needed your rest." She smiled at him sleepily, and for one queasy moment Trevise thought she might suggest renewed activity. But she merely heaved herself about till she was resting on her back. She said in a soft and satisfied voice, "I had you judged correctly from the start. You are a king of sexuality." Trevise tried to look modest. "I must be more moderate." "Nonsense. You were just right. I was afraid that you had been kept active and drained by that young woman, but you assured me you had not. That is true, isn't it?" "Have I acted like someone who was half-sated to begin with?" "No, you did not." And her laughter boomed. "Are you still thinking of psychic probes?" She laughed again. "Are you mad? Would I want to lose you now?" "Yet it would be better if you lost me temporarily." "What?" She frowned. "If I were to stay here permanently, my dear, how long would it be before eyes would begin to watch and mouths would begin to whisper? If I went off on my mission, however, I would naturally return periodically to report, and it would then be only natural that we should be closeted together for a while. And my mission is important." She thought about that, scratching idly at her right hip. Then she said, "I suppose you're right. I hate the thought, but I suppose you're right." "And you need not think I would not come back," said Trevise. "I am not so witless as to forget what I would have waiting for me here." She smiled at him, touched his cheek gently, and said, looking into his eyes, "Did you find it pleasant, love?"
"Much more than pleasant, dear."
"Yet you are a foundationer, a man in the prime of youth from Terminus itself. You must be accustomed to all sorts of women with all sorts of skills."
"I have encountered nothing. Nothing in the least like you," said Trevise, with a forcefulness that came easily to someone who was but telling the truth after all.
Lieselore said complacently, "Well, if you say so. Still, old habits die hard, you know, and I don't think I could bring myself to trust a man's word without some sort of surety. You and your friend Pellerat might conceivably go on this mission of yours once I hear about it and approve, but I will keep the young woman here. She will be well treated, never fear. But I presume your Dr. Pellerat will want her, and he will see to it that there are frequent returns to Camporeon, even if your enthusiasm for this mission might tempt you to stay away too long."
"But, Lieselore, that's impossible."
"Indeed?" Suspicion at once seeped into her eyes. "Why impossible? For what purpose would you need the woman?"
"Not for sex. I told you that, and I told you truthfully. She is Pellerat's, and I have no interest in her.
Besides, I'm sure she'd break in two if she attempted what you so triumphantly carried through.
Lieselore almost smiled, but repressed it and said severely, "What is it to you, then, if she remains on Camporeon?"
"Because she is of essential importance to our mission. That is why we must have her."
"Well, then, what is your mission? It is time you told me."
Trevise hesitated very briefly. It would have to be the truth. He could think of no lie as effective.
"Listen to me," he said. "Camporeon may be an old world, even among the oldest, but it can't be the oldest. Human life did not originate here. The earliest human beings reached here from some other world, and perhaps human life didn't originate there either, but came from still another and still older world. Eventually, though, those probings back into time must stop, and we must reach the first world, the world of human origins. I am seeking Earth."
The change that suddenly came over Mitza Lieselore staggered him. Her eyes had widened, her breathing took on a sudden urgency, and every muscle seemed to stiffen as she lay there in bed. Her arms shot upward rigidly, and the first two fingers of both hands crossed.
"You named it," she whispered hoarsely.
23. She didn't say anything after that. She didn't look at him. Her arms slowly came down, her legs swung over the side of the bed, and she sat up, back to him. Trevise lay where he was, frozen. He could hear in memory the words of Mun Li Kampor as they stood there in the empty tourist center at Seychelles. He could hear him saying of his own ancestral planet, the one that Trevise was on now, "They're superstitious about it. Every time they mention the word, they lift up both hands with first and second fingers crossed to ward off misfortune." How useless to remember after the fact.
"What should I have said, Mitza?" he muttered.
She shook her head slightly, stood up, stalked toward and then through a door. It closed behind her, and after a moment there was the sound of water running. He had no recourse but to wait, bare, undignified, wondering whether to join her in the shower, and then quite certain he had better not. And because, in a way, he felt the shower denied him, he at once experienced a growing need for one. She emerged at last and silently began to select clothing. He said, "Do you mind if I..." She said nothing, and he took silence for consent. He tried to stride into the room in a strong and masculine way, but he felt uncommonly as he had in those days when his mother, offended by some misbehavior on his part, offered him no punishment but silence, causing him to shrivel in discomfort. He looked about inside the smoothly walled cubicle that was bare, completely bare. He looked more minutely. There was nothing. He opened the door again, thrust his head out, and said, "Listen, how are you supposed to start the shower?" She put down the deodorant, at least Trevise guessed that was its function, strode to the shower room, and, still without looking at him, pointed. Trevise followed the finger and noted a spot on the wall that was round and faintly pink, barely colored, as though the designer resented having to spoil the starkness of the white for no reason more important than to give a hint of function. Trevise shrugged lightly, leaned toward the wall, and touched the spot. Presumably that was what one had to do, for in a moment a deluge of fine sprayed water struck him from every direction. Grasping, he touched the spot again, and it stopped. He opened the door, knowing he looked several degrees more undignified still, as he shivered hard enough to make it difficult to articulate words. He croaked, "How do you get hot water?" Now she looked at him, and apparently his appearance overcame her anger, or fear, or whatever emotion was victimizing her. For she snickered, and then, without warning, boomed her laughter at him. "What hot water?" she said. "Do you think we're going to waste the energy to heat water for washing? That's good, mild water you had, water with the chill taken off. What more do you want? You sludge-soft Terminians, get back in there and wash." Treviz hesitated, but not for long, since it was clear that he had no choice in the matter. With remarkable reluctance, he touched the pink spot again, and this time steeled his body for the icy spray. "Mild water?" He found suds forming on his body, and he rubbed hastily, here, there, everywhere, judging it to be the wash cycle, and suspecting it would not last long. Then came the rinse cycle. Ah, warm. Well, perhaps not warm, but not quite as cold, and definitely feeling warm to his thoroughly chilled body. Then, even as he was considering touching the contact spot again to stop the water, and was wondering how Lieselore had come out dry when there was absolutely no towel or towel substitute in the place, the water stopped. It was followed by a blast of air that would have certainly bowled him over if it had not come from various directions equally. It was hot, almost too hot. It took far less energy, Treviz knew, to heat air than to heat water. The hot air steamed the water off him, and in a few minutes he was able to step out as dry as though he had never encountered water in his life. Lieselore seemed to have recovered completely. "Do you feel well?" "Pretty well," said Treviz. Actually, he felt astonishingly comfortable. "All I had to do was prepare myself for the temperature. You didn't tell me." "Sludge soft," said Lieselore with mild contempt. He borrowed her deodorant, then began to dress, conscious of the fact that she had fresh underwear and he did not. He said, "What should I have called that world?" She said, "We refer to it as the oldest." He said, "How was I to know the name I used was forbidden? Did you tell me? Did you ask?" "How was I to know to ask?" "You know now." "I'm bound to forget." "You had better not." "What's the difference?" Treviz felt his temper rising. "It's just a word, a sound." Lieselore said darkly, "There are words one doesn't say. Do you say every word you know under all circumstances?" "Some words are vulgar. Some are inappropriate. Some, under particular circumstances, would be hurtful. Which is that word I used?" Lieselore said, "It's a sad word, a solemn word. It represents a world that was ancestor to us all and that now doesn't exist. It's tragic, and we feel it because it was near to us. We prefer not to speak of it, or, if we must, not to use its name." "And the crossing of fingers at me, how does that relieve the hurt and sadness?" Lieselore's face flushed. "That was an automatic reaction, and I don't thank you for forcing it on me. There are people who believe that the word, even the thought, brings on misfortune, and that is how they ward it off." Do you, too, believe crossing fingers wards off misfortune?
No. Well, yes, in a way. It makes me uneasy if I don't do it.
She didn't look at him. Then, as though eager to shift the subject, she said quickly, "And how is that black-haired woman of yours of the essence with respect to your mission to reach that world you mentioned? Say the oldest, or would you rather not even say that?"
"I would rather not discuss it at all, but I asked you a question."
"I believe that her people reached their present world as emigrants from the oldest."
"As we did," said Lieselore proudly.
"But her people have traditions of some sort, which she says are the key to understanding the oldest, but only if we reach it and can study its records."
"She is lying."
"Perhaps, but we must check it out."
"If you have this woman with her problematical knowledge, and if you want to reach the oldest with her, why did you come to Camporeon?"
"To find the location of the oldest. I had a friend once who, like myself, was a foundationer. He, however, was descended from Camporellian ancestors, and he assured me that much of the history of the oldest was well known on Camporeon."
"Did he indeed? And did he tell you any of its history?"
"Yes," said Trevise, reaching for the truth again. "He said that the oldest was a dead world, entirely radioactive. He did not know why, but he thought that it might be the result of nuclear explosions, in a war, perhaps."
"No,"
said Lieselore explosively. "No, there was no war, or no, the oldest is not radioactive."
"It is radioactive, but there was no war."
"Then how did it become radioactive? It could not have been radioactive to begin with, since human life began on the oldest. There would have been no life on it ever." Lieselore seemed to hesitate. She stood erect and was breathing deeply, almost gasping. She said,
"It was a punishment. It was a world that used robots. Do you know what robots are?"
"Yes."
"They had robots, and for that they were punished. Every world that has had robots has been punished and no longer exists."
"Who punished them, Lieselore?"
"He who punishes, the forces of history, I don't know."
She looked away from him, uncomfortable, then said in a lower voice,
"Ask others."
"I would like to, but whom do I ask? Are there those on Camporeon who have studied primeval history?"
"There are. They are not popular with us, with the average Camporellian, but the Foundation, your Foundation, insists on intellectual freedom, as they call it."
"Not a bad insistence, in my opinion," said Trevise.
"All is bad that is imposed from without," said Lieselore.
Trevise shrugged. There was no purpose in arguing the matter. He said, "My friend Dr. Pellerat is himself a primeval historian of a sort. He would, I am sure, like to meet his Camporellian colleagues. Can you arrange that, Lieselore?" She nodded. "There is a historian named Vasil Deniador, who is based at the university here in the city. He does not teach class, but he may be able to tell you what you want to know."
"Why doesn't he teach class?"
"It's not that he is forbidden. It's just that students do not elect his course." "I presume," said Trevise, trying not to say it sardonically, "that the students are encouraged not to elect it."
"Why should they want to? He is a skeptic. We have them, you know.
There are always individuals who pit their minds against the general modes of thought, and who are arrogant enough to feel that they alone are right, and that the many are wrong. Might it not be that could actually be so in many cases?
Never, snapped Lieselore,
with a firmness of belief that made it quite clear that no further discussion in that direction would be of any use. And for all his skepticism, he will be forced to tell you exactly what any Camporellian would tell you. And that is, that if you search for the oldest, you will not find it. In the private quarters assigned them, Pellerat listened to Trevise thoughtfully, his long, solemn face expressionless, then said,
Vasil Deniador, I do not recall having heard of him, but it may be that back on the ship I will find papers by him in my library.
Are you sure you haven't heard of him? Think, said Trevise.
I don't recall at the moment having heard of him, said Pellerat cautiously. But after all, my dear chap, there must be hundreds of estimable scholars I haven't heard of, or have but can't remember.
Still, he can't be first class, or you would have heard of him.
The study of Earth.
Practice saying the oldest, Genoff. It would complicate matters otherwise.
The study of the oldest, said Pellerat, is not a well-rewarded niche in the corridors of learning, so that first-class scholars, even in the field of primeval history, would not tend to find their way there. Or, if we put it the other way around, those who are already there do not make enough of a name for themselves in an uninterested world to be considered first-class, even if they were. I am not first class in anyone's estimation, I am sure.
Bliss said tenderly,
In mine, pal?
Yes, certainly in yours, my dear, said Pellerat, smiling slightly. But you are not judging me in my capacity as scholar.
It was almost night now, going by the clock, and Trevise felt himself grow slightly impatient, as he always did when Bliss and Pellerat traded endearments. He said,
I'll try to arrange our seeing this Deniador tomorrow, but if he knows as little about the matter as the minister does, we're not going to be much better off than we are now.
Pellerat said,
He may be able to lead us to someone more useful.
I doubt it. This world's attitude toward Earth, but I had better practice speaking of it elliptically, too. This world's attitude toward the oldest is a foolish and superstitious one.
He turned away.
But it's been a rough day, and we ought to think of an evening meal, if we can face their uninspired cookery, and then begin thinking of getting some sleep. Have you two learned to use the shower?
My dear fellow, said Pellerat, we have been very kindly treated. We've received all sorts of instructions, most of which we didn't need.
Bliss said, Listen, Trevise, what about the ship?
What about it?
Is the Camporellian government confiscating it?
No. I don't think they will.
Ah, very pleasant. Why aren't they?
Because I persuaded the minister to change her mind.
Pellerat said,
Astonishing. She didn't seem a particularly persuadable individual to me.
Bliss said, I don't know. It was clear from the texture of her mind that she was attracted to Trevise.
Trevise looked at Bliss with sudden exasperation.
Did you do that, Bliss?
What do you mean, Trevise?
I mean tamper with her. I didn't tamper. However, when I noted that she was attracted to you, I couldn't resist just snapping an inhibition or two. It was a very small thing to do. Those inhibitions might have snapped anyway, and it seemed to be important to make certain that she was filled with goodwill toward you.
Goodwill? It was more than that. She's softened, yes, but post-coitally.
Pellerat said, "Surely you don't mean, old man."
"Why not?" said Trevise testily. She may be past her first youth, but she knew the art well. She was no beginner, I assure you. Nor will I play the gentleman and lie on her behalf. It was her idea, thanks to Bliss's fiddling with her inhibitions, and I was not in a position to refuse, even if that thought had occurred to me, which it didn't.
Come, Janoff, don't stand there looking puritanical. It's been months since I've had an opportunity. You've...
And he waved his hand vaguely in Bliss's direction. Believe me, Golan, said Pellerat, embarrassed. If you are interpreting my expression as puritanical, you mistake me. I have no objection.
Bliss said, But she is puritanical. I meant to make her warm toward you. I did not count on a sexual paroxysm.
Trevise said, But that is exactly what you brought on, my little interfering Bliss. It may be necessary for the minister to play the Puritan in public, but if so, that seems merely to stoke the fires.
And so, provided you scratch the itch, she will betray the foundation.
She would have done that in any case, said Trevise. She wanted the ship. He broke off and said in a whisper, Are we being overheard?
Bliss said, No.
Are you sure?
It is certain. It is impossible to impinge upon the mind of Gaia in any unauthorized fashion without Gaia being aware of it.
In that case, Camporeon wants the ship for itself, a valuable addition to its fleet.
Surely the Foundation would not allow that.
Camporeon does not intend to have the Foundation know.
Bliss sighed. There are your isolates. The minister intends to betray the Foundation on behalf of Camporeon, and in return for sex, will promptly betray Camporeon too. And as for Trevise, he will gladly sell his body's services as a way of inducing the betrayal. What anarchy there is in this galaxy of yours! What chaos!
Trevise said coldly, You are wrong, young woman.
In what I have just said, I am not a young woman. I am Gaia. I am all of Gaia.
Then you are wrong, Gaia. I did not sell my body's services. I gave them gladly. I enjoyed it and did no one harm. As for the consequences, they turned out well from my standpoint, and I accept that. And if Camporeon wants the ship for its own purposes, who is to say who is right in this matter? It is a Foundation ship, but it was given to me to search for Earth. It is mine, then, until I complete the search, and I feel that the Foundation has no right to go back on its agreement. As for Camporeon, it does not enjoy Foundation domination, so it dreams of independence. In its own eyes, it is correct to do so and to deceive the Foundation, for that is not an act of treason to them, but an act of patriotism. Who knows?
Exactly. Who knows? In a galaxy of anarchy, how is it possible to sort out reasonable actions from unreasonable ones? How to decide between right and wrong, good and evil, justice and crime, useful and useless? And how do you explain the minister's betrayal of her own government when she lets you keep the ship? Does she long for personal independence from an oppressive world? Is she a traitor or a personal one-woman self-patriot?
To be truthful, said Trevise, I don't know that she was willing to let me have my ship simply because she was grateful to me for the pleasure I gave her. I believe she made that decision only when I told her I was searching for the oldest. It is a world of ill omen to her, and we and the ship that carries us, by searching for it, have become ill-omened too. It is my feeling that she feels she incurred the ill omen for herself and her world by attempting to take the ship, which she may by now be viewing with horror. Perhaps she feels that by allowing us and our ship to leave and go about our business, she is averting the misfortune from Comporion, and is in that way performing a patriotic act.
If that were so, which I doubt, Trevise, superstition is the spring of the action. Do you admire that?
I neither admire nor condemn. Superstition always directs action in the absence of knowledge. The Foundation believes in the Selden Plan. Though no one in our realm can understand it, interpret its details, or use it to predict. We follow blindly out of ignorance and faith. And isn't that superstition?
Yes, it might be.
And Gaia, too. You believe I have given the correct decision in judging that Gaia should absorb the galaxy into one large organism. But you do not know why I should be right, or how safe it would be for you to follow that decision. You are willing to go along only out of ignorance and faith, and are even annoyed with me for trying to find evidence that will remove the ignorance and make mere faith unnecessary. Isn't that superstition?
I think he has you there, Bliss, said Pellerat.
Bliss said, Not so. He will either find nothing at all in this search, or he will find something that confirms his decision.
Trevise said, And to back up that belief, you have only ignorance and faith. In other words, superstition.
Basil Deniador was a small man, little of feature, with a way of looking up by raising his eyes without raising his head. This, combined with the brief smiles that periodically lit his face, gave him the appearance of laughing silently at the world. His office was long and narrow, filled with tapes that seemed to be in wild disorder, not because there was any definite evidence for that, but because they were not evenly placed in their recesses, so that they gave the shelves a snaggletoothed appearance. The three seats he indicated for his visitors were not matched, and showed signs of having been recently and imperfectly dusted. He said,
Genoff Pellerat, Golan Trevise, and Bliss, I do not have your second name, madam.
Bliss, she said, is all I am usually called. And sat down.
It is enough after all, said Deniador, twinkling at her. You are attractive enough to be forgiven if you had no name at all.